Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anne Ball and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Australia's most populous state is setting up cameras as part of an effort to reduce the number of people preoccupied with wireless devices while they drive. Andrew Constance is Minister for Transport and Roads in the southeastern state of New South Wales. He said Monday that New South Wales would be the first area in the world to use the technology to punish drivers distracted with telephone calls, social media, or text messages. Road safety experts are concerned about the growing number of accidents involving drivers using smartphones on the state's roads. They say drivers who use phones while driving greatly increase their chances of being involved in an accident. Constance said that the New South Wales government plans to place 45 mobile phone detection cameras across the state by December. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation reported his comments. Each phone detection unit contains two cameras. One camera takes pictures of a vehicle's registration plate. A second camera looks through the front window of a car or truck to see what drivers are doing with their hands. The units use artificial intelligence to set aside drivers who are not touching their phones. Human beings then confirm if the pictures show illegal behavior before a notice is sent to the vehicle's registered owner. A violation carries a fine of $232. Some cameras will be permanently set up on roadsides. Others will be moved from time to time around the state. Two fixed cameras took photographs of 8.5 million vehicles as part of a 6-month test earlier this year. The cameras took photos of more than 100,000 drivers with their hands on phones. One driver was using a phone and another electronic device, an Apple iPad, at the same time. Another driver had a passenger guide the vehicle while they both held phones, the state government said. The government wants to expand the program to 135 million photo checks a year by 2023. New South Wales has 5.2 million registered vehicles. Not everyone agrees with the new program. Peter Corey represents Australia's National Roads and Motorists Association. He accused the government of using secretive methods to cut down on illegal phone use. The association supports tougher action against drivers distracted by phones. However, the group wants the government to set up signs warning motorists that phone detection cameras were operating in an area. Government modeling found that the phone detection cameras could prevent 100 deaths and serious injuries over 5 years. A total of 354 people died on New South Wales roads last year. Officials said more than 16,500 drivers had been fined for illegally using phones this year. Drivers are permitted to use phones in hands-free carriers and through wireless connections. But it is illegal in New South Wales to touch a phone while driving except to pass it to a passenger. The ban extends to drivers who are sitting at red lights or stopped in heavy traffic. Andrew Constance said the state government was easing the law to permit drivers to pay with their phones at restaurant drive-thrus.
Technology is widely available to students in classrooms across the United States, a new study shows. The study comes from the nonprofit New Schools Venture Fund and Gallup, a company best known for its public opinion surveys. It found that nearly 9 in 10 U.S. public school students say they use digital learning tools at least a few days a week. And more than half of those questioned said they use digital technology to learn every day. In the new survey, digital learning tools means technology. It includes websites, application software programs, and online classes, games, videos, and programs. The survey found that classroom technology gets high marks from educators. At least 8 in 10 teachers and school administrators said they see great value in using classroom technology tools now and in the future. A report on the survey and its findings was released earlier this month. It is called Education Technology Use in Schools.
Researchers questioned thousands of U.S. public school teachers and students, school principals, and school district administrators. The educators work in schools with classes from pre-kindergarten through 12th grade. The report found that across the country, digital learning is everywhere and it's very integral to learning. Tonika Cheek Clayton told VOA. She is managing partner at New Schools. The fund connects businesses with donors to finance new education technology programs. Clayton says that most U.S. teachers, 65%, use digital tools to teach every day. She adds that more than three-fourths of teachers said the technology helps to improve their effectiveness in the classroom. Educators think it is especially effective in activities like research, information searches, reports, and presentations.
When it comes to preparing students for future employment and careers,
The study found that educators are likely to say technology is more effective than non-digital tools for connecting learning to students' careers. Derek Kelly of Virginia agrees. He coordinates technology for Fairfax County Public Schools, which serves nearly 200,000 students. He told VOA, the important thing is to help prepare the students for real-world experience, and knowledge about technology is something students need. Kelly said technology is just one of many tools available to teachers. Because students learn differently, technology can help teachers support their students by offering different methods for providing information. Traditional teaching, where the teachers are standing up, versus the role of technology in a classroom, I think both are important, Kelly said, and I think there needs to be balance.
In the report, more than half of the special education teachers questioned said technology can help their students. Tony Daniel, a special education teacher, agrees with that. He teaches children with learning difficulties at the Springfield Estates Elementary School in Springfield, Virginia. Daniel says he uses technology tools as a way to extend learning and really enhance how the kids are learning to give them a more hands-on experience. Daniel helps his students learn and do computer coding in class. At times, some of his students like using a pencil and paper, while others want to use technology. He said they have to be taught how to use technology. You really have to think about if that's students' needs are being met and not just, you know, giving everyone a tablet, he said. Critics of technology in classrooms say that students are spending too much time looking at screens on their computers or electronic devices. Concerns about technology overuse is something Derek Kelly's office hears about from the community. So we are making sure that there is a balance with student use of technology, he says. Tanika Cheek Clayton said what is important is that nearly all of the teachers, 90%, limit technology use to less than half of the class time. That was true even for those who use technology every day.
Nearly all elementary students say digital learning tools are fun. Most say the technology helps them learn things on their own and at their own speed. Almost three-fourths of secondary students say the technology tools help them learn things on their own. Over half said they make school more interesting. 42% would like to use it more often at school. And only 8% said they would like to use them less. One thing everyone agrees on, technology is here to stay in American classrooms. I'm Ann Ball.
And I'm Brian Lynn. Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we begin the story of Alexander Hamilton. He was one of the country's founding fathers. He never became president. He did, however, become the country's first Secretary of the Treasury. At that time, the American government was very weak. It had many debts and no money. Many of the country's citizens did not support their own government. Many wondered if America would last. In a few years, however, there was a change. This change was produced in large part by the energy and imagination of one man, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton wanted to make America a strong and important nation. He wanted it to become the equal of the powerful nations of Europe. There is much mystery about the early days of Alexander Hamilton. Some facts about his childhood and youth have been clearly established. Others have not. Historians think he was born around 1755 or 1757. His mother was the daughter of French Huguenots who had settled in the British West Indies. Her name was Rachel Lavien. Historians are not sure who his father was. One story says he may have been James Hamilton, a poor businessman from Scotland. Rachel Lavien lived with him after she left her husband. One thing is certain. His mother died when he was 11 years old. When she died, friends of the family found work for the boy on the island of St. Croix, then called Santa Cruz, in the Virgin Islands. He became an assistant bookkeeper and learned how to keep financial records. Young Alexander was not like the other children. Other children played games. He talked about becoming a political leader in the North American colonies. He read every book that was given to him in English, French, Latin, and Greek. At a young age, he learned a great deal about business and economics, and he developed an ability to communicate ideas clearly and powerfully.
He showed great talents as a writer, very observant, and gained notice when he wrote an account of a local hurricane, which was picked up by the local press.
Valerie Paley is a historian at the New York Historical Society. She says Hamilton's writing was so good that his boss and some other people decided to help him get a good education. They gave him money so he could attend a college in New York City. The boy's plan was to study medicine and return to St. Croix as a doctor. But he never lived in the West Indies again. At King's College in New York City, both teachers and students were surprised by Hamilton's intelligence and clear way of communicating. He often expressed his thinking about the problems of the American colonies. Hamilton was against British rule. He wrote a paper defending the colonists in the city of Boston who seized a British ship and threw its cargo of tea into the water. The protest over taxes became known as the Boston Tea Party. Valerie Paley of the New York Historical Society says Hamilton's upbringing may have influenced his views.
Some historians have argued that he was somewhat stateless. He was adrift. He was his own man. And in a way, there was something so passionately right for Hamilton in joining something as apparently important as a revolutionary cause.
The year 1776 arrived. The 13 American colonies declared their independence from Britain. The declaration meant war. The American Revolution gave Hamilton the chance to show his abilities. He became part of a New York militia and fought in some important early battles. It was not long before Hamilton met the commander-in-chief of American forces, George Washington. General Washington recognized Hamilton's talents. He promoted Hamilton and invited him to become an aide. In that job, Hamilton wrote letters and reports for Washington. Hamilton had to use all his political and communication skills to get money and supplies for the Revolutionary Army. He asked the 13 state governments. He also asked the Congress, which had little political power at that time. He got almost no help from either. Hamilton came to believe firmly that the American system of government was too weak and disorganized. Even so, historian Valerie Paley says Hamilton became one of the most important people on George Washington's staff.
Hamilton had never had a father, of course, that he knew or knew well, so there was something very loyal and very, very trusting about the relationship between the men. So I think it was something that was extremely important and influential to Hamilton's growth as a politician and as a thinker.
She says their relationship was almost like a father and son. But that did not mean their relationship was always good. Alexander Hamilton was a proud man. He was quick to criticize others. He even criticized George Washington. Once, during the war, Hamilton was late to a meeting with the general. Washington protested. Hamilton resigned. For the next 8 years, Hamilton was very busy. He led troops in some of the last battles of the American Revolution. He became a lawyer. He founded the Bank of New York, one of the very first banks in the country. He helped save his old school, King's College, and turn it into what is now Columbia University. He was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. He wrote some of the Federalist Papers, among the most famous documents in American history. Hamilton's defense of a strong central government persuaded many Americans to ratify the Constitution and establish a new system of government. Historian Valerie Paley says Hamilton had a visionary way of thinking about the world.
He thought up, some would argue, the whole notion of what modern America is in terms of the way government works, in terms of finance, banking. He saw the importance of certain structures we take for granted before they even existed.
All Hamilton needed was a way to make his ideas happen. George Washington gave Hamilton that power. When Washington became president, he forgot their disagreement during the war. He asked his former aide to become the country's first Secretary of the Treasury. The job would be difficult.
The United States at that time was a financial basket case.
Business historian John Steele Gordon wrote a book about Hamilton.
There was no real money supply. In the colonial days, they had used a hodgepodge of coins from British and Spanish and Portuguese and what have you. A very chaotic system.
In other words, there was no such thing yet as American money. John Steele Gordon says America also had to borrow heavily to pay for the Revolutionary War. The new nation was deeply in debt. It had to find ways to bring in money and pay what it owed. One way to get money was to borrow it. But no one wanted to lend money to the United States unless they were sure they would get it back. So the Congress asked Treasury Secretary Hamilton to write a report about how to build up the government's credit. Hamilton's report said the government must pay back the full amount of all its debts. This caused a dispute. Many of the debts were in the form of government notes. The notes promised to pay someone for supplying food, clothing, and weapons to the rebel army. Some promised to pay soldiers for joining the army. The notes, however, were really worth nothing. The wartime Congress had no money. People who got them lost hope of ever getting repaid. So they sold them to anyone willing to pay even part of the value. Hamilton's plan would repay the full value of the notes to those who owned them last. Hamilton believed that those who bought the notes had a right to earn money from them. He said these men took a chance that the worthless notes would be worth something someday. Congressman James Madison of Virginia protested. He said the people who bought the notes at low cost should be paid, but not in full. Some of the money, he said, should go to those who got the notes in exchange for supplies or services. Madison made an emotional speech in Congress. He described the situation of former soldiers forced by hunger to sell their government notes for almost nothing. He noted that the Union was established to protect the people against such injustice. Hamilton answered that the purpose of his plan was greater than simply paying debts. He said it was a way to build up the nation's credit so it could borrow money more easily in the future. Many members of Congress felt sorry for the poor soldiers and their families. Yet, they voted against Madison's proposal and supported Hamilton's plan. Still, to win support for his plan, Hamilton had to make a political deal with several congressmen. They would support his financial plan, but he had to use his influence to get the capital of the United States moved. At that time, the capital was in the north, in New York City. Two congressmen from Virginia wanted it in the south, near their homes along the Potomac River. Several congressmen from Pennsylvania agreed, but they said the capital must first be moved to the city of Philadelphia in their state, and it must remain there for 10 years. Congress accepted this plan by a close vote. President Washington signed it into law. Hamilton was still a young man in his 30s, but he had already succeeded in remaking the country's economic policies, and he had established the country's permanent capital in Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. He had also made some enemies. His next plan would create even more.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.